This is KBO of Woodland, Full Strength Community Radio. This is Kabaka Pyramid representing from Kingston, Jamaica. Baby Rock family, you don't know.
You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends.
It's astounding that Greg and Lucia have been producing weekly programs for 35 years, and it stands as one of the last bastions of queer programming on non-commercial radio. So for me, as a historian, these are valuable primary documents by sound. And essentially, it's history as it's happening.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Scotland's new First Minister is Muslim and pro-queer. Kamala Harris defends LGBTQ rights in Ghana. And This Way Out tapped for U.S. Library of Congress project. Those stories and more this week, now that you're celebrating the 35th anniversary edition of This Way Out.
I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Ava Davis.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 1st, 2023. Humza Yousaf will be First Minister of Scotland, and queer equality advocates are expressing relief. The LGBTQ ally defeated two socially conservative rivals to lead the Scottish National Party on March 27th. He was confirmed as the next First Minister in the formal parliamentary election the following day. Yousaf is the first Muslim elected to lead a major UK political party, and the first Muslim to lead a European democracy. One of the critical decisions he'll need to make involves the UK's decision to block Scotland's pro-transgender legislation passed in December. It allowed trans Scots to change their legal gender without medical intervention and lowered the eligibility age to 16. The Scottish government has until mid-April to contest the unusual UK override, an action that has further fueled the movement for Scotland's full independence from the United Kingdom. During his campaign, Yousaf pledged to fight for the rights of all minorities, a pledge that included banning medically debunked queer conversion therapy, whether or not the Conservative UK government finally does. Yousaf also supports embedding LGBTQ rights in an independent Scotland's constitution.
U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris has LGBTQ rights on her agenda as she tours three African nations that criminalize same-gender sex. At a joint press conference on March 27th with President Nana Akufo-Addo, Harris pressed Ghana's government to abandon the draconian anti-queer bill currently moving through Parliament. It would enhance laws that already make private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex illegal. Prison time for offenders would be increased, and conversion therapy would be mandated in some cases. The measure also includes up to a decade in prison for LGBTQ rights advocates. It outlaws cross-dressing and public displays of affection by same-gender couples, and requires citizens to report suspected LGBTQ people to the authorities.
Let me be clear about where we stand. First of all, for the American press who are here, you know that a great deal of work in my career has been to address human rights issues, equality issues across the board, including as it relates to the LGBT community. And I feel very strongly about the importance of supporting the freedom and supporting and fighting for equality among all people, and that all people be treated equally. I will also say that this is an issue that we consider, and I consider, to be a human rights issue, and that will not change.
Without providing specifics, Akufo-Addo claimed that the worst parts of the bill had been toned down. However, he failed to express his government's direct opposition to the bill.
I have no doubt that the Parliament of Ghana will show, as it has done in the past, one, first of all, its sensitivity to human rights issues, as well as to the feelings of our population, and will come out with a responsible response to the proposed. The legislation was a legislation that has been provided as a private member's bill. This is not an official legislation of the government, but it is one that has been being mooted by a handful of private members. So we will see what the final outcome of it. But I'm, my understanding from a recent discussion I had with the chairman of the committee, the substantial elements of the bill have already been modified as a result of the intervention of the Attorney General.
Bill sponsor MP Samuel Narty George disagrees with the president's outlook. He insisted in a television interview the next day that the proposed legislation remains rigid and tough.
Fresh off her problematic tour of Australia, British anti-trans campaigner Kelly J. Keen Minshall got a less than welcomed response when she tried to speak in New Zealand. The rabble-rouser, known as Hosie Parker, gave up and left the country after up to 5,000 people turned out to protest her anti-trans rally in Auckland. She was pelted with eggs, and someone threw tomato soup on her as she was hustled out of the venue by her bodyguards before she could even begin her speech. Thousands celebrated her absence in joyful demonstrations when her scheduled speeches in Christchurch and Wellington were clearly canceled. Posey had already been spotted by reporters in the departure area at Auckland International Airport.
U.S. Republicans are continuing their assault on transgender existence in several states in which they hold legislative majorities. Laws banning most forms of gender-affirming care for transgender people under the age of 18 have been signed into law by Republican governors in Iowa, Georgia, and West Virginia. Democratic Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear's veto of similar legislation was overridden by Republicans. They also overrode his veto of a bill to require trans people to use the sex-segregated public facilities that match their birth certificate gender. Republicans in Idaho also banned trans people from using bathrooms and locker rooms based on their gender identity. This anti-trans crusade is all politics, no brains, and no heart. Florida's legislature passed a bill to ban trans people from using bathrooms that match their gender identity, despite the factual arguments made by this opposition witness.
My name is Caleb Hobson Garcia. I'm a student at Florida State University, and I'm about to graduate with my Bachelor of Science. If this bill passes, you'll be requiring trans men, like me, to use the women's restroom or face criminal punishment. This is rooted in trans misogyny, which is a hatred of trans women. It's rooted in your hatred of non-passing trans people, because being faced with trans people makes you uncomfortable. You haven't even considered what me following the law would look like. It looks like me in the stall next to the females, with my low voice and my facial hair. It looks like me bringing discomfort and potentially traumatic experiences to women. If I follow the law when this bathroom ban passes, it also puts my safety at risk. What happens when husbands see me following their wives into restrooms? This law would open the door to aggressive behavior inside and outside of bathrooms as strangers demand other people prove their gender, making all people less safe. That includes cis people who don't conform to stereotypical appearances.
Republican lawmakers were equally unmoved by the testimony of the father of a transgender child.
I hadn't planned to speak today. My name is Jeff Walker. And what I would like to speak about today is my lived experience as the father of a trans kid. Several years ago, my daughter came to us and she believed she was trans. So what did we do? We went to our trusted pediatrician and he referred us to a gender clinic. And as we've gone through this journey, they have every step of the way, even through the pandemic, been there beside us. No one's pressured my kid to do anything they weren't comfortable with. She is thriving with a group of friends who love and accept her. And when I look at her, all I see is just a happy teenager. And that's all I want for my kids, is to be happy in who they are. So if you vote for this, you're voting for people like me to no longer be able to help my kid and go to people I trust as medical professionals. No matter what's going on, you should believe in doctors. How are they right about everything else? About diabetes, about cancer, about a broken arm, about strep throat, about the flu, but wrong about this. I implore you to vote no and vote this down so that kids like mine can continue to grow up happy. Thank you.
Florida's ambition-driven Republican Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to gleefully sign the anti-trans bathroom bill. Meanwhile, the nation's first ban on drag shows has been put on hold. A federal judge is questioning the constitutionality of the Tennessee law. It was set to take effect on April 1st.
Finally, a song that was released in 2017 has suddenly become controversial in the Milwaukee, Wisconsin county of Waukesha. Superintendent Jim Siebert has decided that Higher Elementary School's rendition of the Miley Cyrus Dolly Parton duet Rainbowland could be perceived as controversial. We are rainbows.
Tell me why a song about rainbows isn't appropriate for a first grader to sing.
Sarah Schindler says her daughter Audrey could barely contain her excitement about singing that song in her school's spring concert. Schindler told Fox 6 News Milwaukee that she thinks Siebert felt pressured by his school board, which tilted farther right after recent elections.
I think for some reason the district and the administration sees rainbows as a political symbol.
Living in a rainbow land, sky's blue and things are grand. To live in paradise, where we're free to be exactly who we are.
To me, that is a message that I want my child to feel. Seven-year-olds should be free to be themselves.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending April 1st, 2023. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Ava Davis. Stay healthy.
And I'm John Dyer V. Stay safe. Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter,
email us at info@thiswayout.org,
and through your financial contributions to our program.
More information and a link to give are online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Around the world in 35 years, This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine, debuted on non-commercial community stations on April 1st, 1988. And at last count, it's broadcast on almost 200 local terrestrial and internet outlets in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, the Philippines, and the USA. In observance of our 35th anniversary, This Way Out CEO and News Wrap producer Brian DeShazer talks to Josh Shepard of the U.S. Library of Congress Radio Preservation Task Force about the show's historic legacy and the project to maintain it. But first, coordinating producer Greg Gordon tells News Wrap anchor Michael Taylor Gray how This Way Out was born.
Someone from KPFK posted a notice. At the time, there was a once-a-month lesbian show and a once-a-month gay men show. And the guy that was doing the gay men show was moving, and so KPFK needed some other new people. And yours truly and two other guys signed up, and we did our first show in August of 1974 on KPFK.
Okay, now in 1979, and again in 1987, you and This Way Out associate producer Lucia Chappell covered the March on Washington for gay and lesbian rights. Greg, why don't you tell us about the 1987 March on Washington?
Lucia and I organized it, and it was also a vehicle for us to recruit other local LGBT radio producers from around the country for what would become This Way Out.
What has been, to you, Greg Gordon, the most meaningful impact that it's had on people world over?
Actually, that's a pretty easy question to answer. When someone tells me, or I'm told, that they listened to our work when they were deeply in the closet, I remember one person, I listened to your show on my headphones behind my closed bedroom door so no one would know I was listening. And it made me feel more okay about myself. This is probably true, Michael, for a lot of us who do active work in the community in whatever capacity, is we remember how challenging it was when we were coming out and how much of a help having that lone supportive voice in the night, so to speak, tell us that we were not monsters, we were not sinful, we were not illegal, we were beautiful human beings just the way we were intended to be. And that's what keeps me going. But I know I'm educating people as well as supporting people, and that's, you know, you can't put a price on that.
Well, thank you, Greg Gordon. Really, thank you so much. Thank you for the work that you've done over the past 40-plus years bringing queer voices to the radio.
Hi, this is Brian DeShazer, and I'm with This Way Out Radio, and we are welcoming Josh Shepard, the Assistant Professor of Media Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder, the Director of the Library of Congress's Sound Submissions Project, and a Chair of the Radio Preservation Task Force. He's also the Associate Editor of Resonance, the Journal of Sound and Culture. Welcome to This Way Out, Josh.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Cool. Well, we wanted to bring you on this particular episode celebrating 35 years of This Way Out International LGBTQ Radio to talk about our preservation and access project that we began about a year ago when we had discussions about the Sound Submissions Project.
Sound Submissions is a collaboration between academics and Library of Congress researchers in the Recorded Sound Division, and we curate materials that are then accessioned into the Recorded Sound Reading Room at the Library of Congress, typically from endangered materials. But one of the benefits of starting this process, once we got through all of the legal counsel and the maneuvering, you know, and all the politics, is that we realized that there are actually great preservation projects that also deserve access for research and public consumption in the Recorded Sound Reading Room at the Library of Congress. So working with This Way Out is our honor because we're accessioning something that we believe to be historically significant that is already going through a preservation initiative on behalf of the show itself. So Sound Submissions essentially becomes a two-sided project. The first is saving materials that we might lose through digitization, but also then curating materials that are historically important that have already been digitized, for which This Way Out is a great exemplar.
Josh, what makes This Way Out a good candidate for this project?
Yeah, it's astounding that Greg and Lucia have been producing weekly programs for 35 years, and it stands as one of the last bastions of queer programming on non-commercial radio. So what I personally love about the show is that you get the voices of people from the community without the filtration of, you know, journalism or other forms of gatekeeping that you find in commercial radio and even some forms of public radio. What we have are the voices themselves talking about issues, doing community organizing, and discussing expediencies that are facing the community at the moment in which the expediencies are happening. So for me, as a historian, these are valuable primary documents by sound. So primary sounds, we'll call them. And it, essentially, it's history as it's happening without another gatekeeper trying to frame the information in between the moments in which people are responding before it reaches an audience.
In 2021, Lynn Ballin of KPFK's Feminist Magazine talked to Lucia Chappelle about that the founding story of This Way Out.
The next march in 87?
87, right.
And we drew all these people together. We said we could make a show with all these reporters feeding their material.
Okay.
It was the early days of the NPR satellite. Mm-hmm. People were just starting to do this instead of, you know, putting cassettes in the mail to each other. We were just starting to learn how to fly on the bird. Uh-huh. And we said we could do this. We could put together a weekly magazine of material from all these different kinds of reporters from everywhere that we now know that we, for heaven's sakes, we've all slept together on the floor.
Right. The trinity. Yeah. So this is the founding story of This Way Out.
Yes.
Which is like every time I picture this door opening, you know, this like opening of possibility when I hear the name, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah.
Wow. What has been the most meaningful impact do you think it's had on people?
I think a real, a solid understanding that we are everywhere.
Yeah.
That the movement is happening everywhere.
Right.
That people are in struggle and confronting oppression in all sorts of different contexts around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to have it all put together in one package. This is our queer globe. It's a really different consciousness mm-hmm. than looking at the movement from the point of view of how much we have progressed here.
Mm-hmm.
Again, Brian DeShazer talking to Josh Shepard, chair of the Radio Preservation Task Force and director of the Library of Congress's Sound Submissions Project.
As the chair of the Radio Preservation Task Force, which is sort of connected with the Sound Submissions Project, there's a conference coming up at the end of April that I am attending and presenting This Way Out in two caucuses. One, the Sound Submissions Project panel, as well as the Gender and Sexuality Caucus. Can you talk about how this connects a radio show with the classroom and how the academics can now be a part of this preservation project?
Yeah, so the conference itself is our fourth conference. The third one got canceled thanks to COVID in 2020. It is kind of like a best practices clearinghouse meeting of all the different stakeholding sectors connected to sound history. So that includes preservation, it includes the curation, it includes the grant writing. And we have representatives, I think, from five different sectors attending. This will be the biggest one. It'll be 325 people or so across about 275 institutions. It takes place at the Library of Congress. They were generous. They gave us 3 days of the entire moving image and recorded sound housing building. That's the Madison building at the Library of Congress, and even a session or two at the main building that everyone visits for tourism, which is the Jefferson Building. And then we're also working with the Smithsonian. We're working with the Smithsonian Libraries and Archives and the Folklife Division, who are generously giving us some space on Sunday, and they themselves are participating. And we are curating a series of radio art and soundscape programming listening sessions, I guess we would call them, so that we could have more than simply discussing best practices and logistics, but could actually really tune in to why radio is an art form and why it deserves to be preserved. And that includes political speech, that includes cultural history on radio. It's not just the experimentation, of course, that creates a certain kind of aesthetic around radio. It's the intonation of voices, it's the difference and the representational elements of voices that are important. And of course, those representational elements of sound history are part of what's interesting to academics. So academics are deeply invested, especially in the fields of cultural studies and history and gender studies, of which I have minor affiliations with all three. They're deeply invested in recognition projects. So a lot of great academic work will revivify lost histories or will contextualize and rediscover voices that were silenced in the past or deemed liminal but deserve to be central to our cultural discussions. So, you know, the thing about getting the academics involved in preservation activities is that it actually creates a kind of momentum. It creates an incentive for the granting agencies, who I enjoy working with in my role with the task force, to give money to different types of sound histories that were not previously preserved. So the symbiosis, if you will, between academic and preservation work mobilizes new research on our end. And then on the preservation end, it actually gives a reason for there to be preservation when there should have been reason in the first place, of course, publicly. But the classroom provides that kind of engine and that kind of audience for there to be money to be distributed for the preservation of these objects. And just as an aside, it costs something like $70 or $80 per recording typically to get it digitized through what we call a vendor. A vendor just being a third party that has the equipment to digitize from the original reel-to-reels. There's tape, there's record, there's reel-to-reels, all kinds of old media that we don't really use anymore. So that being the case, you know, we got to get that money from somewhere, and for that someone to be willing to give that money, there has to be cause or reason, or like a rationale is what they say for grant writing. And so we provide that. So the academics, the research, the classrooms provide a rationale for the more bureaucratic elements of preservation to green light the kinds of recognition work, as we see it, or memory work that is being done through shows like This Way Out.
Well, thank you, Josh. And it's really a privilege and an honor to be recognized by the Library of Congress and the Radio Preservation Task Force and the Sound Submissions Project to bring This Way Out to a level of research and reference and education, which is what it's built on in public radio anyway, in the non-commercial sector. Well, Josh Shepherd, thank you so much for joining us on This Way Out. I really appreciate it and look forward to seeing you at the end of April in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress.
Thanks, Brian. I'll see you there.
If you would like to help us get to the Library of Congress, contact us at brian@thiswayout.org. That's Brian with an I at thiswayout.org. I'm Brian DeShazer for This Way Out.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter,
email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm Olena Shevchenko from Inside Ukraine, a support network for LGBTQI people.
That's next time on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by John Dyer V and Ava Davis and produced by Brian DeShazer. Brian also produced this week's 35th anniversary feature, including interviews by Michael Taylor Glay and Lynn Harris Ballin. Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton, The Beatles, Triumph, and The Moody Blues performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks sustaining funders the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and the Ivana Foundation, and listener donors Richard Merkin and Brad Preyton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors like them make this program possible, so can you. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on the World Radio Network's Global English Language Service through Australia's Community Radio Network and close to 200 local community, terrestrial, and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned, y'all.
90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
You just woke up on the 24th of February hearing those sounds of heavy bombing in the center of the Ukraine, in the capital. I never thought I will experience such events in my entire life. LGBTQI people are so visible, not only on the front line in the army, but also volunteering, doing all those heavy work to support everybody in Ukraine. Russians see open LGBTQI people as a threat to their regime. If you go down, I'm going down
too. Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Trans athletes scored their first points at the U.S. Supreme Court. Drag stars back up Kelsey Ballerini at the CMT Awards, and she backs them. And Ukraine's Elena Shevchenko fights rights battles and the Russian invasion. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Kaylin Hardman.
And I'm Michael LeBeau.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending in April 8, 2023. The U.S. Supreme Court's first ruling in a case involving transgender students and sports has come down on the side of trans athletes. The court refused West Virginia's request to reinstate its ban on athletes competing in sports based on the student's gender identity. The ban has been temporarily enjoined by lower courts while its constitutionality is being challenged. As is often the case with emergency requests, the justices provided no reasoning. Only far-right conservative Justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas wanted the higher court to consider the case. The April 6th decision is a victory for 12-year-old Becky Pepper Jackson and her transgender counterparts across the state. She's been competing in her middle school girls' track and field team while undergoing puberty-delaying treatment and hormone therapy. Her teammates and coaches have welcomed her, even though she's reportedly not that good. Her performance belies the belief by ban proponents that trans girls and women have an unfair competitive advantage. Becky is being represented by the American Civil Liberties Union and the queer advocacy group Lambda Legal. Their joint statement points out that Becky has been a member of the girls' team for the past 3, going on 4 seasons without any problems. It calls the state's actions a baseless and cruel effort to keep Becky from where she belongs, playing alongside her peers as a teammate and as a friend. West Virginia is one of at least 20 Republican-controlled U.S. states to deny transgender athletes the chance to participate in school sports, usually targeting girls and women. Bans in Idaho and Tennessee are also being challenged in federal court. More challenges are expected.
Meanwhile, the U.S. state-level anti-trans frenzy continues around the country. Democratic Kansas Governor Laura Kelly has been vetoing legislation to ban kindergarten through 12th grade trans females from competing in school sports as themselves for the past 3 years. Republican supermajorities in the state House and Senate overrode her veto on April 5th. Governor Kelly is expected to veto another measure to define sex as either male or female at birth. It would also ban trans people from changing the gender marker on their government IDs and other legal documents, and deny their right to use bathrooms and other sex-segregated facilities based on their gender identity. Her Republican opposition will likely override that veto, too. ACLU of Kansas LGBTQ+ legal fellow D.C. Hygart put it bluntly, "We know their real goal is to erase trans people from public life and push us back into the closet."
Indiana and Idaho's Republican governors both signed bans on gender-affirming care for trans people under the age of 18. Governor Eric Holcomb of Indiana expressed concerns about a legal challenge when he signed the bill outlawing hormone treatment and puberty blockers for the purpose of gender transition for young trans people on April 5th. He justified the measure by citing its ban on gender-affirming surgeries for trans teens, even though such medical intervention is extremely rare. Holcomb said, permanent gender-changing surgery should occur as an adult and not as a minor. Governor Brad Little of Idaho took it even farther to the Republican right by making it a felony for doctors and other healthcare professionals to provide gender-affirming care for under 18 trans people. The legislation includes prison terms of up to 10 years. Little's April 4th letter to lawmakers on signing the measure explained that our society plays a role in protecting minors from surgeries or treatments that can irreversibly damage their healthy bodies. About a dozen other Republican-dominated states have now enacted laws to deny gender-affirming health care to young transgender people.
North Dakota Republicans set a scary record by advancing 10 anti-LGBTQ bills just this week. 8 of them are already heading to Governor Doug Burgum. They include a ban on gender-affirming health care for minors and criminal penalties for doctors who provide it. Another bans kindergarten through college-aged trans athletes from competing based on their gender identity in school sports. 2 bills amended by the Senate have gone back to the House for consideration. They would prevent trans people from changing their legal gender on government documents and force them to use bathrooms and other sex-segregated public facilities based on their birth certificate gender. It's not clear how Governor Burgum will respond to the anti-queer avalanche on his desk. He vetoed a bill last week that would have allowed teachers and other school personnel to misgender and deadname trans students. The Senate had enough votes to override that veto, but the effort failed in the House. Another measure awaiting Burgum's signature virtually bans family-friendly drag shows as adult-oriented performances. By most accounts, lawmakers in Republican-controlled U.S. states have introduced more than 450 bills to restrict the rights and self-expression of LGBTQ people just in the first 3 months of this year.
New Jersey is the rare exception for state-level trans rights. Democratic Governor Phil Murphy's April 4th executive order designates the state as a safe haven for people seeking gender-affirming care. The order directs departments and agencies to protect people in the Garden State who both receive and provide gender-affirming care. It explicitly forbids state officials from cooperating with other states seeking to impose civil or criminal liability or professional sanctions on gender-affirming healthcare providers. Murphy is the second Democratic governor to order protections for trans people and their healthcare providers in recent months. Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz issued a similar executive order in early March.
U.S. Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona announced new interpretations this week of Title IX, which would prohibit schools, colleges, and universities from categorically banning transgender students from participating on sports teams consistent with their gender identity just because of who they are. The landmark 1972 Civil Rights Amendment bans bias in education based on gender. The proposals now enter a public comment period. Equality activists are giving the proposed new rules mixed reviews because of the allowed exceptions. An Education Department statement said that the new interpretations allow schools flexibility to develop team eligibility criteria that serve important educational objectives, such as ensuring fairness in competition or preventing sports-related injury. University of Colorado Law School Associate Professor Scott Skinner Thompson specializes in LGBTQ plus issues. He told the Washington Post, "The proposed rule helps clarify that these blanket bans on transgender athletes are in violation of Title IX and is a really positive development." However, Skinner Thompson found allowing exclusion in some cases deeply troubling. "When it comes to the hard cases, this is saying that trans kids can be discriminated against." Progressive Democratic U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York criticized the exceptions in a tweet, saying, "Absolutely no reason for the Biden administration to do this. It is indefensible and embarrassing. The admin can still walk this back, and they should. It's a disgrace." The Biden administration has been denouncing the wave of anti-queer, mostly anti-trans state legislation for several weeks, mostly throughout White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Finally, a federal judge in Tennessee has extended his temporary restraining order preventing a state law banning family-friendly drag shows from taking effect until May 26. This, according to one of the attorneys representing a drag-centric theater group challenging the law. A trial date has been set for May 22nd. Trump-appointed U.S. District Court Judge Thomas L. Parker has already suggested that the wording of the law is vague and that it may cross a line regarding free speech and other constitutionally protected rights. A number of high-profile country music stars have already spoken out against the proposed drag show ban, including Maren Morris, Brooke Eden, and Dolly Parton. They were joined on April 2nd by co-host Kelsey Ballerini at the CMT Awards, a fan-based celebration of country music. Singing her hit, If You Go Down, I'm Going Down Too, on a stage featuring a typical traditional family values white picket fence, Ballerini was accompanied by RuPaul's Drag Race veterans Manila Luzon, Kennedy Davenport, Jan Sport, and Olivia Lux, who danced and performed backup vocals. Our bodies are buried in the same dish, so even if I wanted to, I can't snitch. 30 to life, but go quicker we can lose, yeah. So if you go down, I'm going down too. If you go down, I'm going down too. If you go down, I'm going down too. In an exclusive post-performance interview backstage, three of the fierce queens told Entertainment Tonight what the inclusive appearance meant to them.
Just like all these amazing country music artists, we drag queens are also artists, and we deserve a space to be ourselves, express ourselves, and create something wonderful for everyone to enjoy.
I feel like even the song, you know, if you're going down, I'm going down too, it is about celebration of being a community, and I think that's what we did on the stage tonight, and I really hope that that transcended to people as well, and it felt like it did.
And if there's one thing, do not mess with the LGBTQ plus community, okay? We're here, we're queer, get used to it, baby.
That's News Wrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending April 8th, 2023. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Greg Gordon, edited by Lucia Chappelle, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau. Stay healthy.
And I'm Kaylin Hardman. Stay safe.
G'day, I'm Nate Byrne, weather presenter on ABC TV in Australia.
Hi there, I'm Mon Shafter from ABC Queer.
And you're listening to This Way Out, the weekly LGBTIQ plus radio magazine for all our gender and sexually diverse communities around the world.
And those who love them.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information and a link to give are online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
Lesbian feminist Olena Shevchenko has been a prominent Ukrainian human rights activist for years. On February 24, 2022, her life and the LGBTQ movement in her country was changed forever. Since the Russian invasion, her work has become even more significant, making her one of Time magazine's Women of the Year. Shevchenko left her war-torn homeland to speak at the World Pride Human Rights Conference in Sydney, Australia. While she was there, This Way Out correspondent Barry Mackay sat down with her for this exclusive interview.
Can you tell me about the situation for LGBTQI people in the Ukraine before the Russian incursion? What rights did they have, and how accepted were they in the wider Ukrainian community?
Taken back to their, you know, years before the war, like even 1 year and a half before, I would say, like, in Ukraine we achieved a lot during the recent decade, because we were able, for instance, to go to the streets to organize the protests, to demand our rights. We were visible in media. We talked to journalists openly. So many people did coming out in the recent years, going to talk about their life experiences. And we also successfully worked with different specialists. I'm talking about media, psychologist groups, even with the police. We organized so many trainings, and we also did an advocacy to change our legislation to reach at least some equality for LGBTQI people. But unfortunately, that was just the first steps in our fight, and then the full-scale invasion came to Ukraine. And of course, it is a very hard times, especially for LGBTQI communities now, because on the paper, in our legislation, we are still invisible. We are not recognized as equal people, as equal families. So during the war, we suffered a lot because of that.
How did things change for LGBTQI plus Ukrainians after what Moscow calls their special military operation into the country? What's life like now?
Everything changed pretty dramatically. You know, that's just one of the examples. That's my example. Then you just woke up on the 24th of February hearing those sounds of bombing, heavy bombing in the center of the Ukraine, in the capital. I never thought I will experience such events in my entire life. And then you just realize that it can be the last day of your life, and you don't know what to do. You don't know who will help you. And my experience also showed that even being privileged, because I have been the part of the international human rights community for so many years, more than 15 years, I became pretty vulnerable in this situation. So nobody just came to save my life. And what we can say about the casual, regular LGBTQI people who just, you know, lost everything. They just couldn't call the police. They couldn't call the emergency. They just lost their jobs immediately. They can't even go to the general shelters because of the level of violence there and non-recognition, because they can't go there as a family. They will be separated. The same applies to those who left the country because they are not visible as a family, as a relatives. They're not seen as an equal people, persons. And additionally, the main fear for LGBTQI people was that under Russian occupation, there will be no place for LGBTQI people, especially those who are visible or open, because we know what happened already on Donbas, in Luhansk, in Crimea. Then so many of our sisters and brothers just disappear somewhere. And I think they've been killed because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Those territories which been occupied since 2014 and still under occupation, so we even don't have an access to receive any of information. We just know it from the others who were so lucky to escape from those basements, you know, tortures, killings, rapes, everything.
Have many of the LGBTQI plus community fled the country, and where have they gone?
I would say, in general, that's the same percentage of the general population which left the country. And mainly that's women, lesbians, couples with children. They tried to save their children from the war, and that's understandable. But almost all of them, those who flee the country with our support, they want to come back. They want to come back to those homes which are still there. And even in those cases, then they don't have any houses. For instance, we have many members of LGBTQI communities who became displaced twice in 2014 from Donbas or Lugansk or Crimea. And then they came to Ukrainian territories. And now it came up again, the second phase. And they lost everything twice. And they want to come back, they want to rebuild the country, but they want some guarantees, at least some equality.
Some acceptance.
Acceptance as well. But in terms of acceptance, I think the general society are not against the equality, especially now, then LGBTQI people are so visible, not only on the front line in the army, but also volunteering, doing all those heavy work to support everybody in Ukraine. So I think that our state need to stand and say that this is a very right time to say that LGBTQI people need to be recognized is equal. That's not about specific rights. That's not about some, you know, additional rights. That's just equality for everybody.
I saw a story that there was a transgender person helping out with the resistance effort. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, that's our friend who are now in the army. And we have many of those lesbians, gay, trans people who are serving in the military now, protecting our country.
What's happened to the members of the LGBTQI plus community who are in areas now occupied by the Russian military? Do you know much more about that?
There are so many people who are still on those territories, and I will tell you why. Because it can be seen as a simple answer, like if you need to be evacuated, you need to evacuate yourself from the occupied territories. But that's not so easy. First of all, because it is pretty dangerous. And the second reason, that usually LGBTQI people and women are those who are taking care about others. People with disabilities, elderly people, small children, so they just can't leave. There are no ways to leave somebody without support. So they are staying there and trying to survive somehow. We are trying to give them with many ways, trying to seek, you know, all the time different ways to deliver the humanitarian support, medicines, hormones, everything possible. And we know, like, those people are there, they are waiting for the deoccupation, and they are fighting on their front line. Where they can and what they can do, they do.
And a lot of people, I expect, have to hide their sexuality.
Yeah, many people just trying to avoid any other contacts with others because, you know, due to Russian tradition and the laws, somebody can go to their militaries and saying, like, I know the person from the LGBTQI communities. With Russians and all those, you know, traditional values, protecting families, things which they impose to different territories and also promote on international area, it is very important to understand that it's not just about the identity, LGBTQI, that's also kind of combination. They see us, LGBTQI people, open LGBTQI people, as a threat to their regime because we are doing this civil work on the freedoms or fighting of our rights, and this is the main threat for them. That's why they are seeking for those activists and trying to torture them, you know, doing many bad things and even killing them.
Have there been any issues with Ukrainians getting refugee status in certain countries because of their sexuality?
Before the war, I knew several people who came to different countries in Europe seeking for the refugee status. And it was not so simple. It is still. Because now for Ukrainians, due to the war, so many countries did the exceptional rules which allow us to go to some country and to stay a while there, receiving support, receiving some shelters, receiving some housing, and also a possibility to work. This is something which is still lack in general for all the immigrants and refugees, unfortunately. So these exceptions, by the way, show that that can be also done for everybody else. Because it's not just Ukrainians who are escaping from the violence and death threats. There are so many countries in the world and so many people who are suffering from the same thing, but they don't have any possibility to go to another country, more safe country, because they are not allowed to do that.
I'm thinking of countries such as Poland, which have set up special LGBT-free zones, or maybe Hungary, which doesn't have a terribly LGBTQI-friendly government.
Yeah, unfortunately, on the political level, we know how many countries are still on the stake and trying to push back on LGBTQI equality. The Poland is a very good example, by the way, because Poland gave shelter to so many Ukrainians, and this is like the understandable country for many Ukrainians, and this is so close to Ukraine. So this is why many people trying to go there to be close to relatives, you know, and trying to come back in any chance, then it will be the chance. But those laws in Poland, they are awful. So this is not the best country for LGBTQI refugees or migrants or displaced persons. So mainly they are going to Poland and then trying to go to neighbor Germany, for instance, to be there. And funny thing about LGBTQI free zones, then the war started on the second week. We established a connection with another organization, ELC, European Lesbian Community, which I belong to. They came to Poland and organized few shelters there. So we were able to bring people to the border and gave them on the border so they can host there in Poland. And those shelters were based in LGBT so-called free zones. So the reality is that people in those regions in Poland, they are pretty friendly. They helped a lot. But the thing is, the problem is on the political level. So that is the good task for European Union to do.
So the general populace have been pretty open to receiving LGBTQI plus refugees in those countries, but politically it's been difficult.
It is, yeah, that's on the political level, seriously. It's not about LGBTQI issues. That's about political regime. That's about authoritarianism. It's about the support of, you know, such called traditional values, which is proposed and, you know, pushing by Russia. So we just need to step up as a European community, as a world community, and just to revise this approach to the laws, norms, and everything like that.
Olena Shevchenko's LGBTQI human rights organization website is insight-ukraine.org. That's insight-ukraine.org. Her interview continues next time on This Way Out.
The whole team of my organization decided to stay in Ukraine. We did an amazing job, honestly, starting from the first day of the full-scale invasion.
I'm Barry Mackay.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. News Wrap was reported this week by Carolyn Hardman and Michael LeBeau and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was Barry Mackay. Kelsey Bellarini and Friends and Billy Joel performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson, composer for Wrong About Theme Music. This Way Out thanks listener donors Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. They help make this program possible, and so can you. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media, email us at info@thiswayout.org. For associate producer Lucia Chappelle and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts, and on KGAY, Thousand Palms, Coachella Valley, California, WPKN, Bridgeport, Connecticut, CKUW, Winnipeg, Manitoba, and close to 200 local community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
Called you on the phone, no one's home.
You are tuned to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Calling all denizens of Earth. Tune in to KBOO on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. for KBOO's Earth Day Takeover. It's a whole day of radio programming devoted to climate action and environmental justice. Join us and prepare for nature sounds, music, and activist interviews focused on our shared climate future. That's KBOO's Earth Day Takeover on Saturday, April 22nd from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m. and online at kboo.fm/earthday.